we read God's instructions to us to come before Him on this holy day. So in Leviticus 23, in verses 24 and 25, and this chapter is where it outlines a number of the holy days, and so we're progressing up to verse 24, and it says, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, in the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath, a memorial blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein, but you shall make an offering made by fire unto the Eternal." And, of course, that we've just had our offering. This happens to be that day. We call it the Feast of Trumpets. Obviously, it's a day of trumpets to be blown. We don't have a trumpet player here. Perhaps someday we will be able to play a shofar. I do have some sheep at home with a ram that has the curly horns, but I'm going to have to figure out how to harvest the horns in order to do that. Surely they've done this in the past because it's been happening for thousands of years. The Feast of Trumpets is an interesting time. It's often likened to or speculated that it was that was the a time of the birth of Christ. Of course, that's. But I also want you to take a look at several other possibilities here with regard to or what Christ spoke about when he spoke about. And I'm going to relate it to the Feast of Trumpets in Matthew 22 in verses 2 and 3. And in Matthew 22, verses 2 and 3, by way of introduction to the subject, Jesus Christ was here speaking a parable. And in this particular parable, in Matthew 22, in verses 2 and 3, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son. And he sent forth his servants to call them that were bidden to a wedding that they would not come. Well, I want to focus just on the point that there was the king, in other words, representative of God the Father, setting up a marriage for his son. And so there's going to come a time when, and Christ used this example of a coming marriage. Let's turn just a few pages over to Matthew 25. If we take a look in Matthew 25 in the first 13 verses, and I'm not going to go through them just other than to just to refer to them. This is the parable that Christ offered regarding the wise and foolish virgins. And once again, they were about to be married. And it was their preparation time before they were married. So another, once again, there was a parable about marriage. Now let's turn back. And like I say, this is by way of introduction to the topic, into Isaiah 61. And this is a verse in Isaiah 61 and verse 10. And this sequence in Isaiah is often spoken of with regard to the Feast of Tabernacles, that time that's soon coming. It's actually in the upcoming time where God's rule comes about on earth, that millennial reign. And in Isaiah 61 in verse 10, we read another reference about the bride and the groom and their preparation. In verse 10, "I will greatly rejoice in the Eternal. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he has clothed me with the garments of salvation, and he's covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with ornaments, and as a bride ordains herself with jewels." So there's a coming wedding. There's a coming time of salvation that's put together here, that salvation is put together as if it were a wedding that's coming. And if we go just a few verses more into Isaiah 62 in verse 5, and we can read there just a few verses down into the next chapter, in Isaiah 62 in verse 5, "For as a young man marries a virgin, so shall your sons marry you. As the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God rejoices over you." So here again is an analogy of a wedding, and that God is now rejoicing over us. We're able to join that wedding as participants and not simply as observers. Continuing on in this background, let's turn to Revelation in 19. I'm going to slow down on the verses here in a moment, but I just wanted to show these analogies that the time of the return of Jesus Christ is frequently referred to as a time of a wedding. And so let's turn to Revelation 21. Did I say Revelation 21? Okay. In Revelation 21, And we read about, in starting in verse 1, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I realize the time frame is a little different here, but the scriptures are referring to this again as we read on. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So this concept that there's a coming wedding, it's related to salvation, appears throughout the Bible. One last verse in this regard is Revelation 19, just a page or so back. In Revelation 19, in verse 7, we're going to look at verse 7 and verse 9. And this then, at this time, is speaking of this same end time era. In Revelation 19, verse 7, let's be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife made herself ready. And verse 9, and he says to me, write, blessed are they which are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he says to me, these are the true sayings of God. And so here we have a direct saying that the marriage of the Lamb is come, and the wife makes herself ready. And so we have these examples, and there are many others throughout the Bible, that shows or establishes that there is a relationship, or the concept that Jesus Christ often gave in the parables about a coming wedding. In fact, that wedding would be to Jesus Christ as the groom and the church as the bride. And we hear much about this wedding upcoming, but how much do we hear about the marriage? So today we're going to take a look at what not just the wedding, which is going to occur on the Feast of Trumpets, at some future Feast of Trumpets, but we're going to take a look at the wedding that comes about as a result of that wedding. Linda and I were at a Crown Super bookstore in San Diego during the feast in 1997 when I spotted a book that I had heard about for some years. Well, obviously it was written some years before 97, and that was already, 14 years ago. And you might have heard about the book, too. It was on the New York Times top 10 bestseller list. And the book was entitled His Needs, Her Needs by Dr. Willard Harley. And it's a book about marital relationships. The book was in a special display on the end of an aisle, and I was curious, so I picked up the book. The name of the author seemed vaguely familiar, but I thought it was because I had heard of the book before. Well, I flipped open the book, and I read the flap on the front and back covers, and inside of the back flap was a picture of the author. And again, I thought there was something familiar, vaguely, about the author, but I just couldn't place him. And then it hit me, standing in that Crown bookstore in San Diego, that the author was my college psychology professor from umpty years ago. I went to a small school, Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. What's the chances of that something like that would have occurred? He was a good teacher. He was very interesting. He was innovative and very well respected. So my curiosity then about the book whetted my appetite even more. So what I discovered then in that book, in the book His Needs, Her Needs, opened my eyes to a whole new way of looking at myself and my wife and at marriage in general. Dr. Harley, the author, eventually left his professorship at the college where I went to school, and he went on to establish a chain of marriage counseling centers. But it bothered Dr. Harley that he was not able to help more couples become truly happy. So Dr. Harley spent years trying to understand why marriage counselors almost universally failed at helping to keep marriages together. And it was awkward and it was embarrassing for him as a marriage counselor to see so many failed marriages. Well, Dr. Harley's research led to some amazing discoveries that I'm going to share with you today. But first, let me say that today's message would not have been written if I had not been motivated by the discovery of some of my wife's flaws. Of course, only through marriage would these things have been revealed. First of all, my wife takes glasses from the dishwasher and she puts them upside down in the cupboard. She says it's to keep the dust out of the clean glasses. I, on the other hand, know that the correct way to put glasses and cups in the cupboard is to put them open-ended up, so that any residual moisture will have an opportunity then to evaporate. Well, Then, when making the bed, I've noticed that my wife pays no attention to which way the open end of the pillowcase is placed. I naturally assumed that everyone knew that the open end of the pillowcase is always flopped toward the outside of the bed. And then there's the toilet roll issue. My darling wife routinely installs the paper so that the paper comes off the front of the roll. I patiently tried to explain to her that if we place the tissue so that it will roll off the back of the roll and the back of the dispenser, any child will not be able to readily unroll the tissue just by batting it and thus waste all that tissue. Well, we finally reached an accommodation in our lives regarding our marital distress. Here's how we handle the differences. Whoever empties the dishwasher gets to decide how to place the glasses in the cupboard. Whoever makes the bed gets to decide the direction to put the open end of the pillowcase. And whoever replaces the toilet tissue gets to decide which way the paper should come off the roll. But before we jump into Dr. Harley's discoveries about the human nature and marital relationship, I want to turn to Genesis 1 and read about the first man and first woman. In Genesis 1 and verse 26, This was the time when Adam was alone, or when Adam was being created. And Genesis 1 and verse 26. And God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Verse 27, and so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female he created them. Well, just to be sure that we didn't miss the point that we were created in God's image, he repeated that in Genesis 5:1. And so God created mankind after his own image and his own likeness with the potential to have the characteristics of God. Now, many years ago, when I was courting my wife, Mr. Barron came up to me in church one day, and he teased me with the following verse. In Proverbs 30, he just mentioned the verse. I had to go look it up for myself. And he prodded me with Proverbs 30 and verse 18. Amazing I should remember that after these years. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yes, four which I know not: the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Well, the way of a man with a maid is indeed a marvelous thing. It's a challenge to understand, as is the marvel of a marital relationship that mirrors our relationship with God. So as mankind increases in knowledge over the years, we discover more and more about ourselves, and in so doing, we discover more and more about God, because after all, we are made in his likeness. And then we look to the Bible and realize that the knowledge that we are discovering was right there in front of us all the time. Well, doctors and researchers have discovered some amazing things about the human body and how it's built, how it has an amazing capacity to heal itself, to reproduce, to perform fantastic feats, whether it's running a marathon of 26 miles, swimming the English Channel, which is 20 miles wide, or climbing Mount Everest over 29,000 feet high. Researchers have also discovered some things about people's emotional makeup, and this provides some explanation as to why people do what they do. Well, Dr. Harley describes the results of research in his book, His Needs, Her Needs, the one that I mentioned earlier. And I believe it's on the church-suggested reading list. So I'm not coming off the wall. This is something that's somewhat known throughout the church. Dr. Harley describes that research and explains his discoveries in what he calls the top 10 emotional needs in marriage. So today I'm going to go through that top 10 list of emotional needs in men and women. And as we do it, we'll see how meeting our emotional needs corresponds to our relationship with God, particularly as we keep in mind the focus that today pictures that Feast of Trumpets, that time of that wedding where we will marry the Lamb that we read about in Revelation 19. And so with that in mind, we're also going to then compare a human relationship as we go with our relationship as the bride of Christ. and as we relate right now as we prepare for that wedding. So today's message can be heard on two levels. One is on a purely human plane, if a physical or emotional level, where someone could simply walk in the door today and care nothing about religion, and should be able to walk away with the knowledge that would be helpful in their own relationships or to help them prepare for a future marriage. In another way this message can be heard is to understand the spiritual analogy so we can develop a better understanding or relationship with God, because we have a better understanding of what God expects of us. Dr. Harley found that men and women have the same top 10 emotional needs in marriage. Imagine that. We're created from the same flesh, or the same by the same God, and we have the same top 10 emotional needs. However, there's a caveat. The top 5 emotional needs for men are different than the top 5 emotional needs for women. In other words, the priority order of emotional needs is different. God refers to his relationship with spiritual Israel as a marital relationship, that Israel is a bride awaiting her husband. And we've already gone through Isaiah 62 in verse 5. Throughout the Bible, God admonishes us to be faithful to him, to be faithful to the truth and not to stray. So the powerful language that God uses for someone who forsakes the truth is the same language that he uses to describe someone who's unfaithful to their spouse. And that's pretty strong language. If we look in Ezekiel 16, verses 1 through 63, and we will not go through all 63 verses, but the entire chapter explains in Ezekiel 16 why, or that God's love for Israel and how Israel frequently spurned God's love to chase after other spiritual lovers, false gods, and how God equates physical fornication or adultery with spiritual fornication or adultery. Well, I'm going to go through the top 10 emotional needs for married people and show how these points can help us in our marriages, how they mirror our relationship with God, and how we can look forward to that relationship the marriage relationship that will be sounded someday by that trumpet. Well, the reason for studying these top 10 emotional needs for married people is that if these needs are unmet, then we're candidates for unfaithfulness to our mate. Similarly, if we do not follow God's expectations of us, then we're candidates for straying from God and his truth. So first off, here's the top 5 emotional needs for women. Number 1 is the need for affection. God created women. He knows that women need regular affection. Of course, men also need affection, but it is the highest emotional need for women. Men, unlike God, need a written reminder to love their wives, to give them daily affection that they need. Some men often need a slight nudge to remember anniversaries, birthdays, and special events. Other men need more than a nudge, because a gentle hint doesn't always work. Ephesians 5 and verse 25 is one of these bold statements. Husband, Ephesians 5, in verse 25, is that not so quiet reminder. In Ephesians 5:25, it says very clearly, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it." So the need for wives to have affection is so profound that it often dominates their feelings and overwhelms or bypasses their other needs. Some women have told me that certain husbands are almost incorrigible in this area. It's sad, because to the point of tragedy, because it's a woman's most important emotional need. The directive for husbands is so strong that it's repeated again in Colossians 3 in verse 19. In Colossians 3, in verse 19. Husbands, love your wives, and then it adds a little something to it. Be not bitter against them. I should probably point out right here that it's not a very good idea for women to take the last two verses and bash their husbands over the head with reminders to be sure to love them. These verses are meant for men to understand and to follow, and not for their wives to use in skewering them as if they were meat and vegetables on a kebab stick. The reason for Colossians 3:19 is because men need to be reminded. It's really hard for a man to be spontaneous when his wife asks him if he loves her. I'm reminded of the story of the fellow who had been married for many years, But he was not very expressive to his wife, and so she craved so much to hear the words, "I love you." She snuggled up to her husband and asked him that fateful question, "Honey, do you love me?" Whereupon he held up his hand, he showed her his ring, and he says, "Remember when we got married and I said I love you?" She said, "Yes," with anticipation. He said, "Well, if I ever change my mind, I'll let you know." Well, Dr. Harley doesn't leave anything to chance. So he has developed a list of things that otherwise clueless men can do to show affection for their wives. And I want you to think of this not just in the physical, but also I want you to think of the spiritual analogy when we go through Dr. Harley's list. And he's lettered it A through J. So how many is that? About a dozen things here. Hug and kiss your wife every morning while you're still in bed. Do we think of our spiritual bridegroom every morning before we get up? B, tell your wife that you love her while you're having breakfast together. Do you allow God to express his love for you when you're dining in the morning, not just on breakfast food, but on spiritual food? Kiss your wife before you leave for work. Do you have a close enough relationship with your God that you can be affectionate with your God before you go to work? Call her during the day to see how she's doing. And this is, again, suggestions for men. How often do we consult with our bridegroom, Jesus Christ, during the day? Bring her flowers once in a while as a surprise. Be sure to include a card that expresses your love for her. Well, how often do we give that extra something special? Letter F, get a gift for her on special occasions. Sentimental, not just practical. This is probably one of the toughest jobs that any man will ever attempt. I mean, if I wanted to get something really nice for my wife, I know she would appreciate a vacuum cleaner. But it's probably not the most sentimental gift that I could probably come up with. Here, dear, here's a dishwasher and a vacuum cleaner. I mean, she would appreciate that, but it doesn't carry the sentiment that they're talking about here. So it's tough for men to learn how to shop for a woman. are we prepared? Because Christ has delivered our needs for us. He knows how to shop for us and deliver for us. So we need to, as to be able to fill wives, we need to learn, fulfill their emotional needs. We need to learn how to shop for them. Letter G, after work, call her before you leave for home so she can know when to expect you. And, of course, this was written at a time when husbands were home and their wives, or wives were home and their husbands came home. With this hubbub world, it doesn't always work that way. But in other words, announcing or having reasonable expectations of what's going on. It's that close communication. The letter H on his list, when you arrive home from work, give her a big hug and a kiss and spend a few minutes talking to her about how her day went. This is sort of a parallel to the children, to the Raising Kids God's Way seminar that we had a few years ago. Here is spending that one-on-one time, even with the kids around, it's just when the parents are together, to continue that bond. How often do we continue that bond, even after a busy day, with our Creator and future bridegroom? Help with the dishes after dinner, meaning participate in the household. And J, that would be letter I, help with the dishes, or the household activities. And the letter J, hug and kiss her every night before you go to sleep. Do we have a close relationship with our Creator every night before we go to sleep? So you can see, just as an affection is important in marriage, so Christ gave us an example of how he loves his bride, the church, and how we should do likewise. Well, Jesus Christ loved the church so much he gave up his life for it, and despite our personal waywardness, Christ continues to remain true and steadfast to us. In John 3:16, we are reminded of that God, in John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And of course, that's what we read about with the reason for the Feast of Trumpets is that announcement of that marriage, that wedding, and the marriage thereafter, that shows that great love that God has for us. So affection is a woman's most fundamental emotional need. That's the number one of the five. God provides that love and affection for his church, and husbands need to model their behavior accordingly, show affection for their wives. Second most important need for a woman is conversation. When a couple first begins to date, they just can't talk enough. Usually a courting couple will explore and seemingly talk about everything. They will explore the world with their conversations. And then they get married and the conversation slows down to a crawl, almost to a stop. Scientists believe they have discovered a substance that causes men to stop talking to their wives. After generations of research with millions of people, it can now be revealed that the offending substance that causes men to stop talking to their wives is wedding cake. Once men eat wedding cake, it seems that their brain locks up and their vocal cords become almost inoperable. Some of you may have heard, a number of years ago, there was a book entitled Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus by John Gray. The author so accurately describes how men tend to clam up under distress, and I can't say that I'm very different, how they go into their cave and quietly, privately reassess their situation, perhaps lick their wounds. Then, while the man is in his cave, hurting but recuperating, his wife comes into the cave and tries to drag him out by having a conversation with him. Of course, bearing in mind, this is her most important, or second most important need is conversation. Of course, the man refuses and becomes resentful, and then that's often when the man turns into a fire-breathing dragon and the wife feels a bit burned because he's not thinking about the conversation end and she's not thinking about his needs, which we'll come to in a bit. So it's quite the opposite for a woman when she feels distressed. She gets on the telephone with her mother, her sister, daughter, friend, or neighbor, and discusses endlessly every nuance of whatever burden she's feeling. Although men don't share this emotional need for conversation to the same degree, men need to understand that a woman needs conversation. She thrives on it. It is her survival. Mr. Scriber, Leonard Scriber, my pastor from many years ago, I think when the Jacksons and I were both attended in Eugene, Oregon, told this story. And he said, imagine this situation. And he went through this scenario. A man gets up about 4 in the morning. He brews a pot of coffee and pours it into his thermos bottle. He makes a couple of sandwiches and he goes out to the garage to gather up his fishing gear, which he places in the back of his pickup truck. He drives across town to his buddy's house where the two of them hook up a boat trailer to the pickup truck. The buddy stows his fishing gear in a cooler in the back of the pickup truck, and at 5 a.m., the two of them jump in the pickup and drive off to a faraway lake for a day of fishing. They arrive at the boat landing about 6 a.m., unload the boat from the trailer. They remove their fishing gear and cooler from the pickup and place it into the boat. One guy parks the pickup while the other guy holds the boat next to shore. Both guys jump in the boat and fish all day long. At the end of the day, the two guys reverse the process that they did that morning. They load up the boat onto the trailer, toss their fishing gear into the back of the pickup, and head home. They unhook the trailer, sort out the fish, return to their respective homes. By the time that both guys arrive home, neither man has spoken a complete sentence to each other all day long. Just grunts, shrugs, and an occasional one-word question or reply. Now, imagine two women doing the same thing. Of course, that's the fundamental difference between men and women. Men see nothing unusual about that scenario, and most women cannot even imagine such a happening. I did some reading a while back, and I found out that the number of words per day spoken by a male is 7,000 to 9,000 words a day. And the average words, number of words spoken by a female is somewhere around 25,000 to 27,000 words per day. If they spoke at the same rate, words per minute or words per hour, through the day, men would stop talking about 11 a.m. and women would continue for the rest of the day, and that is their emotional makeup. Now, conversation doesn't involve only talking. In order for women to effectively pour heart out to her husband, he must be willing to listen, to participate in the conversation. After all, God listens to us. In Psalm 62, in verse 8, in Psalm 62 in verse 8. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. So if we take a look at what we expect God to do, we expect him to listen to us. And in that conversation, we are expected to pour our hearts out. God is setting that example for us, that he's quite willing to listen to us. It's then that after hearing his wife, an attentive husband will discern if she only wanted someone to listen to or if she wanted him to actually do something about whatever it is that concerns her. After all, God graciously performs for us what when we diligently seek him. My wife clued me in on this one. It was, she didn't want me to solve all her troubles. She just wanted me to listen. And that's difficult because in business for many years, that was been my job for most of my life. As a university research manager, I got all the troubles. In business for years, for many years, as a manager, I got all the troubles. They just came, and it was just natural. Solve the problem, move on. Solve the problem, move on. So when my wife comes to me and she's explaining to me something, well, I just solve the problem. Okay, now let's move on. But she clued me in that that really wasn't, perhaps, didn't fill her need as well as it could. If we turn to 1 John in 5:14, in 1 John 5:14, when God performs for us what we diligently seek from him. In 1 John in 5:14. And this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. Verse 15, and if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have petitions that we have desired of him. So just as wives thrive on the conversations with their husbands, so do members of God's church thrive on keeping in close conversation with God. There's an example of this in Daniel in chapter 6 in verse 10. In Daniel in chapter 6 in verse 10. And that, of course, Daniel was one of those who was the princes of Israel when Israel was carried off into Babylon, and became a governor, as it were, a man of importance in the occupying empire. In Daniel, in chapter 6, verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, and at this time, this is when the emperor said that he would be the only one that could be worshipped as a god. And Daniel didn't really follow along with that because he was going to worship the one true God. And so he had determined to do something quite different. In Daniel 6, verse 10, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, meaning the law that went into place, forbidding worship of anyone except the king or the emperor, he went into his house, and his window being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed, gave thanks before his God as he did before. And if we skip down a few verses in Daniel in 6, verse 13, and then answered they, this is his accusers, and said before the king that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regards you not, O king, nor the decree that you have signed, but makes his petitions three times a day. Just as then as Daniel kept in close contact with God by pouring out his heart to God three times a day, we should consider his example in maintaining our daily conversation with our God. King David of ancient Israel did not limit himself to praying three times a day. He was open enough to, with God to praise God seven times per day. In Psalm 119 in 164, it's just a short verse, seven times a day do I praise you because of your righteous judgment. So both of these fellows are examples given to us about that close relationship with God. How many of us talk to our spouses seven times a day, let alone talk to God seven times a day? So conversation is critically important emotional need, not just in our marital relationship, but in our relationship with God. Dr. Harley has conversational tips for husbands and wives. If you have the book, he's listed them out. I think I will pass over some of them today. There's quite an interesting list. He suggests that couples spend 15 hours a week in one-to-one communication. That's a lot for most people. How many people can take their schedule of 168 hours a week, block off what is remarkably close to 10% of it, and say that's one-on-one conversation with your spouse? But of course, that will meet the need for the wife. Well, similarly, how much time do we spend in conversation with our Creator? And that should also help to meet our needs, how much our Creator is talking to us, or that we're talking to our Creator. The third point of the third one of need for women is honesty and openness. It's the women's third highest emotional need. It's hard for men to be open. They're often less conversational and expressive than women, yet it's one of women's highest emotional needs. Remember the example from John Gray's book that Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, about men crawling into their caves and not verbalizing or admitting their difficulties. But women, on the other hand, tend to seek out other women with whom they can share that conversation and that feeling. Most men won't admit that they have physical ailments, even if they have a broken leg and the bone is protruding from the skin. And I will admit that I've tried to shrug off things that perhaps shouldn't have been shrugged off. So then you can say, well, is it any wonder that men live on average about 7 years longer, or women live about 7 years longer than men? Men are often in denial about such things. Statistics show that married men live longer than single men because married men have someone to look after them. However, there's no difference in the lifespan of single women as compared to married women because married women tend to take care of themselves better than men. Of course, there are exceptions, but those are the statistical averages. Regarding their health, it's tough for men to be honest with themselves, much less be open and honest with their wives. In Galatians 6 and verse 2, just a short verse, but it speaks somewhat to this issue. In Galatians 6 and verse 2, bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. So let's look at it in this context, that openness and honesty that the bride would like. And as we project that into our relationship with our coming groom, openness and honesty is important to our bridegroom, to Jesus Christ. So we must be open and honest. So bearing another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Similarly, in James 5 and verse 16, confess your faults one to another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. So this opportunity to be open and honest is urged in the Bible. And who better to share the burdens with than your closest human companion, your spouse, or spiritually, we as the brides of Christ, to share our concerns with the bridegroom, Jesus Christ. The fourth point, that's the fourth most highest emotional need for women, is security or financial support, you could substitute in. The most remembered verse that people point to in this regard or think of is 1 Timothy 5:8. But if any man not provide for his own, and especially those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. 1 Timothy 5:8. So providing for one's own, and of course that's a special admonition to do what is within your capacity to do that, because that's one of the tests of your faith. So when we have our spiritual lives in order, and we seek God's first, then God provides our physical needs. And we see that in Matthew 6:31. It's not all on our shoulders. Because we, as the bride of Christ, can rely upon our husband as that time comes, and as the bridegroom now, in Matthew 6, verses 31 through 33. for God to provide our physical needs. Therefore, take no thought saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewith shall we be clothed? Verse 32, for after all these things do the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you have need of all these things. And before that, all these things are a whole list of our human necessities and comforts. Verse 33, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. God takes care of us. All we have to do is ask. And of course, how to ask? There are sermons been given on this, Bible studies, and many articles written, is how to ask. And Matthew 6:9 summarizes it quite well. In Matthew 6:9, in the model prayer. And just a few short verses. After this manner, therefore, pray you, our Father which is in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. So just as the wives have the need for our security, so do we have the need for that support and security, both physically and spiritually, in that sense of daily bread. Matthew 7:9, just the next chapter over in Matthew 7 and verse 9. Or what man is there of you whom if his son asks for bread, he will give him a stone? And so if we ask of our Creator and God the Father for physical bread or spiritual bread, will he deny us? Of course not. So it's the nature of God to supply his children with their needs, just as man is made in the image of God. So man needs to follow his example to supply bread to his family and support those who are unable to support themselves. And of course, as members of the church of the firstborn, and I didn't put the scriptural reference, but we carry the responsibility of the firstborn. So physically we feed our families, and spiritually we must carry out the gospel mission by providing the operational or the spiritual food to the world, which is what we do through as members of the church. The fifth principle, or the fifth emotional need, is family commitment. Every wife wants her husband to be a good father. To be a good father takes effort. I was extremely fortunate to have a wonderful father. My father died over 5 years ago. Yet his continuing presence in his family's life looms very large. Dr. Harley developed a list of what's most commonly admired in a father. And he put these things down in his list of what people want as a father, what they admired most about fathers. And there's 10 things on this list. Meals together as a family. Going out for walks or bike rides. Attending religious services, conducting family meetings, playing board games together, attending sports events, and I'll run down this a second time if you're noting it, reading to the children before bedtime, helping the children with financial planning, family projects. So the list of 10, meals together as a family, going out for walks or bike rides, attending religious services, conducting family meetings, playing board games together, attending sports events, reading to the children before bedtime, helping the children with financial planning, helping the children with homework, and family projects. Now, my father did not do all of these things, and he was still a wonderful father, because he wasn't real big on helping us with homework, because we surpassed his math stuff by about seventh grade as we were into new math and imaginary and natural numbers and stuff that they hadn't even talked about when he had graduated from high school. But he made provision for us to have time and space to do that homework. He worked well with the financial planning. Reading to children before bedtime. He didn't do a lot of reading, but he provided the books for us. When our country one-room schoolhouse closed down, he purchased half of the library at the auction and stocked the shelves at home so that that opportunity was there. Board games together, family meetings, religious services. I don't think I ever saw my dad ride a bike. But we did walk together, and one of the times that's most memorable for me was growing up on a farm, and the fields would be up to a half a mile long. And we would have a tractor and a hay rack, a flat rack with a little with boards along the side raised up about a 2x2, and we would pick up rocks off the field that might damage the either planting or harvesting equipment. And so we would walk a half a mile down and a half mile back, each of us taking a swath of land about 30 feet wide, and pick up all the rocks, put them on this wagon. And he had four sons that were all teenagers at the same time. And we had wonderful discussions. So talking, when they say going out for walks, this was not leisure in our family. But we still had an opportunity to participate together. And one thing I remember is we always had meals together. So if we look at this in our Father, our spiritual Father, our Heavenly Father is just that, our Father. That we are the children of God the Father. If we take a look in John 1 and verse 12, it's talking about who the children are in this case. In John 1 and verse 12, but as many as received him, to them he gave the power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. Jesus Christ was quite willing to welcome them into his Father's family, that they would have the power to become the sons of God. And that follows up in Romans 8:14 with the same thought in the letter to the Romans in Romans 8:14. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God are the sons of God. So if we just then reflect, and going back, we've already read Matthew 6:11 about giving us this day our daily bread. We really wouldn't bother to go back to praying to God if God was unable to deliver. So this family commitment or family security, which is one of the top five emotional needs for wives, that family commitment or security, is performed by our spiritual Father and is what wives look for in the men that they want to father their children. Well, we've covered then the top five emotional needs for wives: affection, conversation, honesty and openness, financial support, and family commitment. Now, here's the top five needs for husbands. I don't think I have my cell on me, so it could be a buzz somewhere. The top five emotional needs for husbands. Now, mind you, these are also among the top 10 for women, but they're the top five for men, and the top five for women are displaced. Each one of them has a higher priority than the other, but they're all there in the top 10. And number one is physical intimacy. In Genesis 2 and verse 18, this is in verses 18 through 24. I'm just going to pick out a verse or two here. And this is when God created a woman, and it said it's not good for a man to dwell alone in verse 18. He will make a helpmeet for him. And we skip down to verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So in Genesis 2:18 and 24, it really doesn't sound too complicated. Boy meets girl, boy and girl fall in love, boy and girl get married, have children, the cycle of life starts over again. I mean, it's all encapsulated what starts right here by men and women coming together in marriage. When I went to country school as a lad, I learned a little rhyme, a saying that most of you perhaps know, one that was old as the hills. Johnny and Susie sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. First comes love, then comes marriage, and along comes Johnny with the baby carriage. So from that, physical intimacy is, for men, physical intimacy is their highest emotional need, and they want their wives to be at one with them. Just as their wives' top emotional need is affection. Those top two emotional needs go hand in hand for an optimal relationship. When husbands and wives strive to meet each other's top needs, they're able to enjoy a more fulfilling relationship. Similarly, we as church members should look at fulfilling the expectations of God, to be at one with Him. Ephesians 4 and verse 31 speaks directly to this issue. Ephesians 4 in verse 31. Ephesians 4:31, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." We just read that back in Genesis 2:24. But look on to the next verse, verse 32, Ephesians 4:32. "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." There's a direct relationship here in the marital relationship between Christ and the church and a man and his wife. So, with a man wanting that physical intimacy, let's take a look at the parallel of how God expects us to become one with Him. And, of course, we're going to have a real taste of this in about, probably taste isn't the best word, in about 10 days, that at-one-ment opportunity. In Leviticus 23, we started out today about the holy days, and we started out reading about the Feast of Trumpets. Let's turn to Leviticus 23 and verse 26, where we read about the next holy day that's coming. In Leviticus 23 and verse 26, also on the 10th day of the 7th month, there shall be a day of atonement. And it shall be a holy convocation to you, and shall afflict your souls, and offer an offering made by fire to the Eternal. Well, afflicting your souls means fasting or giving up without food or water. And it goes on to be more descriptive of what's expected on that Day of Atonement. And so this at-one-ment is important, so important that God has set aside one of His annual holy days to remind us of the necessity to be at one with Him. It's that at-one-ment. In Philippians 2, verse 5, that at-one-ment is demonstrated. In Philippians 2, 5, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." So too, as we should have the same mind and be at one with Jesus Christ, so too should husbands and wives be at one with each other in intimacy. The second highest emotional need for men is recreational companionship. When a couple is courting and they spend a lot of time together, the women may go hunting or fishing with her husband. Perhaps they'll go to a ball game together. Maybe she'll follow him around the golf course a time or two. Maybe they'll play tennis. Whatever the recreational activity, she goes along because she wants to be close to him. And then she partakes of the wedding cake, and her interest wanes in pursuing sports and other recreational activities. Several years ago, I attended the June wedding. Oh, you remembered that one. Several years ago, I attended the June wedding of a young man in the neighborhood where I grew up. In November, it was deer hunting season, and the young man wanted so much to take his bride deer hunting. So he purchased all the gear for her, and he bought her a new hunting rifle, the best of everything. She dressed up in warm clothes because it can get bitterly cold in Minnesota in November. The young husband brought his bride over to my farm and then put her on a good vantage point on the top of a pile of rocks that were piled up next to a tree along a path where the deer were known to travel. There was about 50 feet between the pile of rocks and where that tree was and a huge ditch that the deer would go around or go next to it. So there was a small path for the deer to go by. And then he trudged off a quarter of a mile away to take up a less desirable hunting position. But he wanted his wife to have a good experience, and so she would sort of be hidden behind the tree and on top of the pile of rocks, have a good vantage point. Well, after 15 minutes of sitting on the pile of rocks, a large buck deer with a rack of antlers, impressive rack, came along, and the bride calmly aimed and fired, bringing down a trophy buck in the first 15 minutes. That's the first and last time that she ever went hunting with her husband. She thought the entire experience was not very challenging, and she couldn't imagine what men ever got out of hunting and why it took so long for them to bag a deer. Well, I venture to say that most women do not recognize it, but recreational companionship is the second highest emotional need for a man. If his wife doesn't fill this need, he'll be off with his fishing buddies or his hunting buddies, and a man will be frustrated until this need is met. Remember that story we told earlier, Mr. Scriber told, about the two guys going off fishing. Well, Dr. Harley proposes that the couple find recreational activities that they can do together to help draw them close to each other, rather than for each of them to go off in their own separate directions. My wife loves to roller skate, and she's good at it. And if I'm careful, I can survive on roller skates. She can skate backwards better than I can skate forwards. And I know that roller skating is an enjoyable activity for her, so I've tried to become a better skater so we can enjoy that activity together, rather than us go off in our different directions and increasing amounts of time pursuing separate interests. And with that note, I will note that there's a fellow teacher at her high school who is close in age who has recently broken her leg roller skating. So one must also be careful in these regards. So recreation is the term that we use when we refer to spending time doing the things, that the non-occupational things that we enjoy. Well, my wife likes roller skating. I like going to county fairs and state fairs. A few years ago, we jumped in the car on Friday before a Labor Day weekend, and we drove to Minnesota from here. We went to church in Minneapolis, and then the next day, on the Sunday before Labor Day, we visited the Minnesota State Fair, the largest state fair in the country. And for the first time in her life, my wife saw what it was like to see 100,000 people in one place at one time. The streets were so crowded with people, you could have walked from one side of the street to the other just by walking on the tops of people's heads. And there was so much to see and do. So we are to learn and share our recreational activities. And you notice in the word recreational is creational. God also enjoys recreational activities. And if we read through those creational activities in Genesis from in chapter 1, you'll find a delightful and splendid summary of how God created the earth and everything in it. And I'm just going to just zip through it. Genesis 1, God said, let there be light. He divided light from darkness. There's a firmament in the midst of the waters, divided the light from the waters. Let the waters be gathered together and dry land appear. Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb-yielding seed, and the tree, fruit tree after its after fruit after its kind. Let there be lights in the firmament to divide day from night, and signs for seasons and for years and or for days and years. And God made two greats, the greater to rule the day and the lesser to rule the night, and he made the stars. You get the idea, this was exciting. This was creational. This was something that he enjoyed, particularly enjoyed doing. letting the waters bring forth abundantly, that the moving creatures have life, and that the water, that the fowl may fly above the earth. Creating the whales and every living creature, let the earth bring forth living creature after its kind. And then finally in verse 26, let's make man in our image after our likeness to have dominion over the fish of the sea, fowl of the air, and over the cattle and all the earth and every creeping thing that's on the earth. And then verse 28, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply and replenish it and so forth. And in verse 31, God had saw everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. What an exciting time. What an exciting opportunity. That was delightful. It was pleasurable for God, and he saw that it was very good. So mankind, like his creator God, likes to make things and create and increase his knowledge. There's a constant thirst for more knowledge. That desire is increasing, and that desire is increasing as we go to the end of this age. I'm not going to turn there, but Daniel 12:4 about at the end of Daniel to shut up his words and seal the book to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro. Knowledge shall be increased. So wives should understand, work to understand and meet their husband's need for recreational companionship, things that they love to do. And husbands should consider their wives' recreational needs as well. Number three, of men's needs, and the third most important emotional need is an attractive spouse. Dr. Harley defines attractiveness as what you do with what you have. The fact is that men are visually oriented creatures, and women learn from an early age to play to men's weaknesses, because that is a man's weakness. As a result, women are constantly dressing to look good, while men just stand in awe. There are far more women's dressing or clothing stores than men's clothing stores. If you visited a mall, you can see that. Particularly, far more women's shoes are sold than men's shoes. Of course, a great deal more jewelry is sold to women than to men, not to mention cosmetics, lotions, hair care, and nail care. I was at a school and I saw a girl wearing a printed sweater that said, "Girls rule while boys drool," which pretty well summed up much of life, it seems. Most women seem to know that men look for and are proud of an attractive spouse, and men feel a sense of self-worth and accomplishment when their wives take time and effort to care for themselves. The spiritual analogy is similar, that God wants his church to be attractive and without blemish. In Song of Solomon, in chapter 4, in verse 7, in the Song of Solomon, I don't recall referring to the Song of Solomon speaking very much, but in this place, it speaks to the issue. In Song of Solomon, in chapter 4, verse 7, "You are all fair, my love. There is no spot in you." In other words, something that shouldn't be there. There's no spot in you. In Ephesians 5, verse 27. In Ephesians 5, verse 27. And it's speaking of that time that's represented by this day and the Feast of Trumpets and this coming wedding that we are to be married to Jesus Christ. In Ephesians 5, 27, in that time when that transformation, that wedding transformation will come, in Ephesians 5:27, "that he might present to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish." The third reference to be spotted, as it were, is in James 1:27. Pure and religion, in James 1:27, "pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world." So we have a responsibility in our own lives to clean up as we do, as we're preparing to be the bride of Christ, to keep ourselves from being unspotted by the influences that come from around us in the world. Given that this is one of men's most important needs, it's to have an attractive bride. It's one of the saddest things to see a woman who does not make good decisions. And we've all seen it somewhere before. Proverbs 11:22. "And it's as a jewel of gold in a swine's snout, so is a fair woman which is without discretion." When the Bible uses the term fair, it usually means attractive. So, as a jewel of gold in a swine's snout, of what value is that? "So is a fair woman which is without discretion." In other words, one that doesn't make good decisions. So God views attractiveness differently than man views attractiveness. In other words, you want to see a good decisions made, and it's just heartbreaking to see a pretty gal that makes decisions that are hurtful or harmful to her. If we move on to how God views attractiveness, let's take a look at 1 Samuel 16 in verse 7. 1 Samuel 16 in verse 7. "But the Eternal says to Samuel, look not on his countenance nor on the height of his stature, because I have refused him." It's the time when Samuel was about to anoint someone to be the future king of Israel. "Because I have refused him, for the Eternal sees not as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Eternal looks on the heart." Well, husbands want their wives to be attractive to them, and God wants the church to be attractive to him. And so we should do our best in our lives to be attractive, to be an attractive spouse for our bridegroom. Because our spouse expects that, as Jesus Christ expects it, in our coming marriage to him. The number fourth, or the fourth highest emotional need for women, is domestic support. A man values peace and quiet when he gets home. However, when he arrives at the door, he's often besieged with problems of the day from his wife and his children. Well, that's probably never going to change. But because the nature of man is. But a man desires domestic tranquility. The peacefulness in the home is a precious commodity to the husband. Now, some couples have learned to prevent the situation from developing by making the first 30 minutes upon arrival at home to be a pleasant time, free from troubles of the day. I know in Growing Kids God's Way, they suggest 15 minutes for the parents to spend time together alone at the end of the day. So that they can sit down together and converse and do it quietly and gently when the husband and wife are home together. The distribution of household duties is often a bone of contention. Who does what? The husband pulls out his Bible and he quotes Proverbs 31 verse 37, and he says, this is the Proverbs 31 woman, and he says, she looks well to the ways of her household and eats not the bread of idleness. Well, then she throws up her hands in exasperation and wonders how he could be such an uncaring and unhelpful cad. So she throws up the next verse in verse 28 in his face and says in Proverbs 31, verse 28, her children arise up and call her blessed, and her husband also, and he praises her. Well, he's supposed to praise her. So he becomes angry and confused that his hard work all day long is not appreciated. So when he gets home, she feels similarly overwhelmed and disrespected. So then he pulls out Proverbs 21, verse 9, and Proverbs 27, 15, and says to her, it's better to dwell on the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. Or Proverbs 27, 15, and a continual dripping on a rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Well, in reality, what the woman wanted was some friendly husbandly affection and adult conversation after a day with children. At the same time, the husband just wanted to plunk down in an easy chair and vegetate for a few minutes. But a verbal battle developed, and she tells him to go ahead and live in the corner of the rooftop if that's the way he really feels. How much different would life be if they understood what the other person needed at the time instead of letting their imaginations and their mouths run wild? So that, the number four emotional need is domestic support, is to come to an accommodation as to how they are going to deal with that on a daily basis. Number five on the emotional needs for men is admiration. Every man wants to be admired by his wife. He wants to be thought of as the king of his own castle, the emperor of his realm. When a man is admired, he feels respected, and that motivates him to do even more. If women knew this secret about men and how it motivates them, the wives would find things to mire about their husbands to the point the husband would wear himself to exhaustion just to keep up with his avid wife's admiration. This trait of admiration must be taught. In Titus 2:4, it explains about that teaching mechanism. In Titus 2:4, and it's speaking here to the older women, in Titus 2:4, that they, meaning the older women, may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, and to love their children. Well, admiration is a component of love. When a wife shows admiration to her husband, he's more willing to push himself to meet her emotional and other needs. Our Creator God is similarly worthy of admiration, and we are called upon to love God in a profound way. In Deuteronomy 6:5, and you shall love the Eternal, your God. In Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Eternal, your God, with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. It's reworded slightly differently in Deuteronomy 11:1. And you shall love the Eternal, your God, and keep his charge, and his statutes, and his judgments, and his commandments always. And a few verses down in Deuteronomy 11:13. And it shall come to pass, if you hearken diligently to my commandments, which I command you this day, to love the Eternal your God and serve him with all your heart and all your soul. In other words, there's the if, then there's the blessings that will flow forth from that. In Mark 12 and verse 30. It speaks of the first commandment of love that Christ summarized in Mark 12 and verse 30. And you shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart, with all your soul and all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. So if we do love God so profoundly, then we're going to admire what God has done for us, what he is doing for us, and what he promises to do for us. So a summary of men's top five emotional needs is the physical intimacy, recreational companionship, an attractive spouse, domestic support, and admiration. The Willard Harley puts in his book this interesting quote: "If I do not try to meet my spouse's need, and she does not try to meet mine, we may be technically married, but we will not know the happiness and fulfillment that marriage should provide." That works not just physically, but it also works spiritually. If we don't try to meet Christ's expectation of us, then we will be very frustrated, and we will have not earned the blessings that Christ and his Father are so willing to give to us. So the research in the book, His Needs, Her Needs, is clear. When husbands and wives do not meet each other's emotional needs, they are ripe for unfaithfulness and infidelity. However, when we do our best to meet our mate's needs, then our lives are more ordered and happy, and our own needs are more likely to be fulfilled. Similarly, when we do not perform our spiritual responsibilities, we're ripe to become unfaithful to God. And the Bible is replete with admonitions against physical and spiritual fornication. The Bible is also filled with the promise of hope and joy for fulfilling relationships if we follow His ways. Now, at this point, we could say that this part of the message is through, but I do have something that I want to end this with. And I just want to go down the Ten Commandments in closure. And I want you to think of them in both terms, in the physical sense and then in the spiritual sense, and call this summary the Ten Commandments of Marriage. And you can follow along if you want in Deuteronomy 5, verses 7 through 21, or in Exodus 20, verses 1 through 17. Because we're going to use the original Ten Commandments as a guide. And so if we go through this, these Ten Commandments, to summarize God's expectations of us to be the proper bride for Jesus Christ. And His expectations start, and you can follow through the Ten Commandments. In the first commandment, have no other gods before God. In other words, have no other husband or wife except your own. If everyone invested as much time in their marriage as they did planning a summer vacation, their summer vacations would be a whole lot happier. Number two, do not make a graven image of God. What this means is you treasure the real spouse and not a substitute for your spouse. How often do we see in other people how one spouse keeps busy with activities that takes them away from their own spouse or their own husband or wife? Number three, do not use God's name in vain, which means speak kindly and properly about your spouse. There's no benefit to calling the husband the old goat or referring to the wife as the old battle axe. Proverbs 31 says to praise your mates. Commandment 4, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Your life will live longer and happier if you have an opportunity to stay within the faith. God's plan is spelled out in the Sabbath and the holy days. How delightful it is when you're able to share your life's hopes and dreams with your spouse. And your Sabbath is a refuge to spend time with your God. In Commandment 4, honor your father and your mother. It's interesting that however you treat your parents is how your children are going to treat you. It also has a bearing of how your children think of God. Husbands, then, honor the mother of your children, and wives, honor the father of your children. And that's how children learn to honor their parents. Commandment 6, do not murder. This means to uphold your spouse's good name by showing yourself worthy of that name. You don't denigrate your relationship by spreading around the mistakes of your mate. Commandment 7, do not commit adultery, which means remain faithful to God and His truth. And for young people, that means being true and faithful to your future spouse before you ever get married. Oftentimes they say, well, it doesn't matter, I'm not married. But it does, to be true and faithful to your future mate. Live a life that you can be pleased to share with your husband or wife and someday your grandchildren. Commandment 8, do not steal. What that means is make time for your spouse and treasure the time with your spouse. How many times have lives been lived in quiet desperation because one or the other spouse had other things to do? In Commandment 9, do not bear false witness, which means don't lie. That's being open and honest with your wife. A couple who is at ease with each other, who are meeting each other's needs, will be honest and open with each other. In Commandment 10, do not covet. This means to be happy with your own spouse and don't interfere with the happiness of other couples. Another way of putting it is don't touch a hot stove or you'll get burned. Consider the consequences of your actions. Thought precedes sin, so quenching the wrong thoughts prevent them from becoming a problem. So today we've covered the top 10 emotional needs for men and women. We've learned how to become a better husband and wife to each other by finding ways to meet our spouse's needs. And we've seen how God fulfills our spiritual needs if we seek Him, and how we should look on our responsibilities before God, and how we can then fulfill God's expectations of us as being the proper bride that will happen upon the wedding that's signified or announced on this day of trumpets, on some future feast of trumpets, and that we can carry forward those Ten Commandments and apply them as well, not just in our spiritual lives, but in our marital lives as well.